Put it out of its misery. It's in pain, and it's your responsibility.
It was just an accident.
If you walk away now, it'll starve to death. Is that what you want?
I'm not doing it.
It's all right. It's in heaven now.
What's wrong with you?
Hey guys, welcome back to Spooky Tuesday, a weekly podcast where we're breaking down all of our favorite slashers, thrillers, monster movies, and black comedies on the new scariest day of the week. I'm Sydney Thompson.
I'm Monica Height.
And I'm Chelsea Death.
And this week, after weeks and weeks of ravaging our brains, ravaging, it's not what I was trying to say.
We're ravaging
our brains. We're starting off really strong. Also known as racking our brains. That's another thing that we could have been doing. We were thinking, what's the perfect winter movie that we could give to our sweet spooky listeners? What just says winter? You know what I mean? And it took us a really long time. We asked you guys all for your requests, and then we said no to all of the things that you suggested.
Can I put you on blast? We actually had decided after you recorded the video, but you were like, well, I'm going to post it anyway. So
that's so
we
true.
Needed
that's
to.
True.
We need to stop out those suggestions for later.
I had already recorded it.
What, you're going to waste that content? I don't think so.
And also someone recommended the Mothman Prophecy, and I need to see that now. So, what? Okay.
A title. Yeah.
I don't know what it's about still, but I'm trying to get it into cryptids this year, so it seems like a great way to start.
You have to establish that.
But has Mothman ate your ass at Denny's?
Not yet, because I haven't gotten into cryptids yet. That's what I'm going for, okay?
That's not beginner entry-level stuff, Sydney. That comes later.
And I'm also not starting off in the right way either. I'm reading this book that's just by people who believe it a little bit too hard. It's too hard, too fast. I was like, I need the lore first. I need to ease my way into it. These people are like, it could have been an upright bear or an upright wolf. Or it could have been a clone from the military. And I was like, okay, well, I'm just a little bit too far into this. But anyway, that's not what we're doing. We're not doing the Mothman Prophecy. I haven't told you what we're doing yet. Still a mystery. All I've told you is that it's winter and there's many coats in it. It's very exciting. The movie is 2009's Orphan. And I'm just going to do it right now. This is the IMDb logline for it. Husband and wife who recently lost their baby adopt a 9-year-old girl who is not nearly as innocent as she appears.
Great job. Loved
it. That's it. And so I'm the only person here who had seen Orphan before, and I only saw it just a few months ago because I saw Orphan First Kill come out, and I was like, I need to see this because the reactions are really like wide ranging. And so I gotta do the fucking research first and see the original. Sure. So this is just a gateway drug to get us to Orphan First Kill. But what did y'all think?
You can go first, Sydney.
I know that there is like a real life happening of this movie.
Well,
that happened after.
There's a lot of similarities.
This movie inspired someone to do the same thing,
honestly. I think maybe the other way around with the adults scheming rid of their child, it seems. I don't know. I haven't forensically examined this person who says no, I really am 16 or whatever. But
which one are y'all talking about?
Because I didn't do any research on the real life stories because I figured y'all would tell me. So you have to tell me from the start.
The Natalia Grace Barnett one is the one where she's saying, no, I really did come here at age 6. And then my adopted parents told me to say that I'm 22 and sent me to live on my own and go to college, but I really am my age that I say that I am. But then there's also a weird thing from the Czech Republic from like 2007, where someone was living seemingly as a child with a family, and there was weird child abuse stuff that happened, and then that person was maybe revealed to be an adult leading a cult. And then also
layers,
so much going on. There's also, if you ever watched that documentary, I think it was called like the Imposter. Yeah, The Imposter, about Frederick Bourdon. I don't know how to say his name. It's French. He's French. He is a con artist from France who pretended to be a missing American child and then was brought to be reunited with that child's family, but he is very much not that child. And there was this whole thing of like, why was this family accepting this person as their missing child when he so obviously was not that? But that's a whole other separate, but there's like a lot of like weird things. But yeah, I mean,
knowing what I know, that's interesting, and that's all I'll say. If you know Spookies, I'm winking at you right now. Anyway, continue.
I think, didn't the Natalia one, didn't the court rule based off of like dental records and stuff that she was fact a 22-year-old woman with a rare form of dwarfism, pretending to be a child with a rare form of dwarfism?
I don't know. I didn't research it super strongly. I just read a BBC article.
The last thing I read was like the courts got dental like records and it confirmed that she was in fact 22 years old.
Did these things happen after this movie came out? Because that's
so happened in like 2012 or something like that.
That's so weird because even the dental shit is part of this. I mean, obviously the dental shit will be part of it because your teeth do give you the fuck away.
Like, that's, I think she started wise. I think it started in like 2008 and like went through into like a really long time, and like and this movie came out in
2009. Imagine being her and this movie comes out and I don't know if she would have caught wind of it, and she's like, oh fuck, oh fuck, oh fuck, oh fuck. The gig is up. Hollywood has come up with my insane story. Will they start to realize now?
Okay, update from the Lafayette Journal and Courier. Sorry, I said that so weird. It just came out of my mouth that way, and I'm going to move forward.
We said ravaging our brains, so.
Yeah, this is from August 2022. So the most recent update is that the parents in that case are facing neglect charges, and the trial in August was postponed. So I don't know that the trial has happened yet, so I don't think that the courts have determined anything, if they're still being held on trial for neglect charges.
I think they are. It's not child neglect. It is like because she has this rare form of like dwarfism, it becomes like a disabled person neglect, and not like she's an adult, but she's a disabled adult. Like, just
ditched her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They there's an SEO section in here. How old is Natalia Grace Barnett?
It's so interesting.
Yeah, because it was on Dr. Phil, so it got like super sensationalized.
I've been down this rabbit hole. There was like right before the pandemic in like 2019, a bunch of podcasts did stories on this. Like 6 podcasts did a story about this, and I was like, what?
I mean, it's a freaking wild concept. It's also a brilliant concept to translate into a horror movie. Like, say what you will about the film, because there are many things that can be said and bad things about it. But I mean, it's a brilliant concept because one, it plays on the number one fear that I have. It's like kids are kind of freaky, you know, just innately. They're kind of freaky already.
And I love that for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool, but like, so that's the reason why every horror movie has a bunch of little kids in a choir singing a song, you know, because it's fucking scary and it freaks you out. They sound too cherubic and there's something wrong. You know what I mean? And this one's like, what if that kid is actually fucked up and you're not just afraid of kids, Monica? What if they're actually something there to substantiate it?
They were like, you know what I mean? What if that kid was named Esther?
Don't be named the name Esther. That's a family name.
I have no beef with the name Esther. I think that it's beautiful in its own way. Very hard to make into a nickname, though, which is unfortunate.
Esty?
Oh, Esty?
Yeah.
Well, that's a great nickname. That's our favorite Han sister.
Or wow. You can just call her a great name. Fur?
Yeah.
Fur. There's a lot of great options here. But yeah, I really love this movie. I think that it's very creepy and immediately very creepy. I think the beginning like really made me think that this was a James Wan movie for a second, and I was like scared. I was like, I don't remember this movie being like this, because it's like the dream sequence. Do you remember the opening?
Yes.
How could we forget?
I had to cover my eyes for so much of that.
It was so fucked up, and it was all like, you know, the weird like undersaturated, all the reds are very red.
And Peter Sarsgaard playing the doctor under the mask with just his eyes popping out, and then he's also there to be the dad. Scary.
I know. It's very scary. It's like he I don't know. I mean, I'm glad I'm not a dream analyst. I can't tell her about that. But it's just it starts out very, very fucked up, and it just keeps on going that way. I mean, just they really pack it on in the first like 15 minutes. It's like she has a traumatic miscarriage. She like then turned to alcoholism, and then her child almost died. And then the stepmom is such a cunt to her about it. It's just like so intense away. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to say stepmom. I meant to say mother-in-law. Yeah, mother-in-law is what I meant to say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you compare it to Insidious, actually. Or did you say Insidious? Okay, good.
No, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking Insidious.
Which is, like, very much, you know, in the timeline, they're super nearby each other. And this movie was, like, before The Conjuring, but obviously we watched it afterwards. But... I mean, I don't know exactly what I was expecting. I remember seeing trailers for this movie back in the day, and I don't remember the moment that I learned what the twist was. I just, like, know what the twist is and have known for pretty much as long as I've been aware of this movie, almost. And I think I was expecting a lot more of, like, a James Wan Insidious vibe, which I didn't get from this film, and I really liked it for the most part. I was pretty impressed with what I got.
No, yeah, totally. I mean, I just think the beginning sequence felt like him, and I think he also drew a lot of tropes that he used in Insidious from this movie. There's just like a lot of things that you can point directly to, like the child drawings being a big part of the reveal and all of that stuff. The fact that Vera Farmiga is an accomplished pianist and songwriter,
Insidious. Yeah. That's so real.
We're seeing these connections. We see you, James Wan, but who could help being inspired by such a film, you know? The Orphan it's got it going on. And the costuming really slaps as well. I personally was really inspired by Vera Farmiga's spiky bangs that she had going on, because I too rocked those in 2009. and I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll say usually I like to take a lot of notes when I'm watching, both to preserve my thoughts for the record, because I'm obviously a historical figure, but also because it helps me feel prepared for the podcast. But I made the brave, bold, strong, creative, inspiring decision this time around to just watch the film for fun.
Wow.
And not be just sit there and watch it for fun and let my brain have whatever experience it was gonna have. And then I jotted down some thoughts later, and I thought, like, maybe I'll watch it a second time. I don't know. But like, I really liked it a lot more than I thought. I feel like I was like super engaged in the film, which is nice, both because I wasn't like creating any distractions for myself in the way that like when I watched Cursed a billion years ago, for example, and they said something about The Last Wolf in LA. And I paused the movie and I went on a 45-minute Wolf in LA research journey. You know what I mean? And then I came back and, like, I'd already seen it, so it didn't interrupt my view. But that happens. I'll do that all the time when I'm watching things. Like, I'll stop and I'll Google whatever question I'm having watching the movie. Not, like, about the plot or whatever, but just, like, who is that? Where do I know them from? Totally. Maybe, kinda, like, more often I should. Yeah, pacing, maybe more often, you know? I should just vibes it.
Yeah. No, I try to have. Like, sometimes I'll be taking notes and I'll be like, I'm just writing down, like, every thought that I have. And it's just like, my thought is, oh my God. Like, I don't, no one needs that. Like, I'm not going to know what that means later. So I, like, really pared down. Also, my phone died while I was watching this. It was amazing. Ooh, like, couldn't take any more notes. It was
so
iconic.
Immersive.
I know. Yeah. But I did have the pause a few times because I knew what was going to happen and I knew it was going to make me go eek. And so I had to just take a moment and take a little bit of a breath.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Like I said, in the beginning, I had to cross my hands, and so I only had a little square through which I could microdose the film, and I had to do that at least one or two other times in the movie, so I did feel, like, emotionally affected and, like, sucked in. I was engaged.
Yeah. No, I mean, good. I'm glad that you had this, you know, low-intensity viewing of a high-intensity film. I say that I didn't want to write notes, but I did write two really funny notes. I'm going to say them right now.
Okay.
I said that the husband looks like a ripoff bootleg of Colin Firth, and I stand by that. I think he looks like what you would draw Colin Firth as if you don't really know how to draw and you'd seen a movie with him, like, a couple of months ago, maybe 6 months ago. Just saying. And then also there's that one part where Vera Farmiga is looking in the mirror and she's just having a nice time doing her nighttime routine. And she opens the mirror and he's right there. And I wrote, having a husband is a jump scare. And I think that's accurate as well.
Sure.
Their relationship was so fucked up. They had a lot of issues. They were really trying to work through it, but there are so many layers. Like, every time you thought they were working through one thing, then he was like, and you cheated 10 years ago. I'm just like, oh my God. And that lady wants him to move a chair. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had seen Peter Skarsgård in some previous projects, including a Joey King movie called The Lie or something like that, which, I don't know that we'll ever do, but it sure was wild to view. He also was in a season of The Killing, which is a show that I definitely watched, but I don't remember the plot of, so it may have, like, impacted my vibes of him, but not specifically, maybe. But he's, like, played a lot of untrustworthy roles, or, like, a little scummy, scrappy of a role, and so he kind of brought those vibes with him to this for me, or maybe that's just the vibe of his character, I don't know. But yeah, I thought they did.
He kind of got that look on his face where he looks like he's up to something.
Yeah,
he just, like, has, like, you know,
just up to
kind
no
of
good
smaller eyes, but he looks like he's, like, kind of, like, you know, glaring at you a lot. That's kind of his, he's got resting glare face for me.
He was in Garden
so
State,
I felt judged
also
by him. Oh, I've never seen Garden State.
You've never seen Garden State?
Yeah, I know. It's very anti to everything about me, but I have not seen Garden State.
I unfortunately was one of those people in high school that was like, Garden State is so meaningful. I'm going to buy it on iTunes, and I still own it on iTunes.
I'm going to be that person now at 29 because I really want to see it.
But he has, like, a slightly scuzzy personality in that as well, if I recall. Yeah. But so I think
he's not
cast for that, but I think this movie does a really good job of justifying everybody's mistrust or lack of confidence in each other for the most part. There's, like you said, there's so much going
maddening
on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's so maddening just, like, watching no one believe a word that Kate is saying. But then you think of her history and you're like, fuck, you know, it's really fucked up. But
it's
okay,
hard to build up trust and goodwill once it's gone. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
But, you know, he's not all bad because he does make that weird pun where he calls a snow orphan a snorfin.
Why did he call it a snow orphan at all? It's a snow angel.
I'm like, you're about to adopt this orphan, so you're being weird about it. Like, please calm down. Like, I don't even know.
I don't know that they like to be called orphans these days, but I guess that's the title of the movie, so we're rolling with it terminology-wise.
He's not calling him an orphan. He's calling him a snorfin. Norfin. And so he's lightening it.
Just, it's casual if you add the snore in front. Yeah.
I mean, okay. I don't blame them for liking Esther, I guess, at the beginning. But I feel like there shouldn't be, like, random strangers allowed to be alone in a room with a child. Just saying, just in general, as a general
especially
rule.
But... a man.
I know. I was like, I feel uncomfortable. And there I know were... what happens in this movie.
Yeah, I can't say I'm terribly familiar with, like, group home, foster home systems and the practices in place of how things are actually supposed to play out when you are adopting a child. But it seems really counterintuitive to me that you get to take them home after meeting them one time. They don't have to do a home visit with the child. They don't have to do any mandated counseling or anything like that. Obviously the timeline is left a little unclear in this film, but the fact that it's not suggested that they see a therapist until after something has happened, and everyone treats it as like, wow, you are crazy to suggest that anyone could ever benefit from seeing a therapist, like, unless they're unwell, is like, we could all benefit, and this is a big transition for anybody, so like, maybe we should have just had that in place as a support from the beginning.
Is it the 2009 of it all? I don't know. Probably. But like, yeah, also I think that the movie was already 2 hours and 3 minutes long, and
I
so
did not expect it to be so long.
It was fucking
so long.
Is that why you hated, like, it, Sydney?
One of the reasons.
Sure
I think some of it could have been cut, and I have things to say about that when we get to the end, but like, I thought I was entertained the whole time, but I'm glad that they didn't waste any of the minutes on like the mandated counseling before they brought her home.
Sure.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yes, I agree. But also, and again, I don't want to talk about this yet until the end either, but reading IMDb trivia, it was very revealing about so many different scenes that didn't make it from the script to the filming process, or that were like filmed but were alternative endings or alternative scenes on the DVD or whatever. Like, I don't want to talk about those yet because I want to talk about the film that we did watch first, but I think the power of editing really shone on this project. I'll say
I love that
editing is so important. It's so important to have a good editor.
It is. Otherwise, you just let the director put all the scenes in that he wants. No, that's why James Cameron's movies are so long, because no one tells him no.
Yes, or like, okay, not to stir up old Phantom discourse, but the whole thing about Doctor Who was often that, like, Stephen Moffat, when he was not the showrunner, had some of the most creative, exciting, scary, whatever episodes. But then when he was the showrunner and there was nobody to really, like, help focus an idea or help trim it or whatever, they just got a little wacky, is a term that I feel comfortable using at this time.
Too wacky, one would
say. A little
say.
Unedited. Ooh, yeah, I mean, like, everybody needs a good editor, and unfortunately, so sad, not everybody has access to one or accepts having one.
Yeah. I mean, but back to the orphanage part of this, like, it was really contentious at the time, which makes a lot of sense. There was a lot of backlash from, you know, places that house orphans across the land, probably from orphans as well, being like, this is fucked up and is gonna make people not want to adopt. Oh, adoption agencies is the words I was going for. Adoption agencies all over the world were like, what the fuck? And so there's that line in the movie where they're like, oh, it must be hard for you to love a child like that's as much as your biological child, or something like that. I botched it, but it's something like that. And it was in the trailer. Mm-hmm. Or to love an orphan as much as your biological child. And it was in the trailer, and they nixed it from the trailer because they were like, okay, we don't actually need to have that sentiment going all across the continental United States and the world in this like marketing campaign.
They did keep it in the movie though.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, they kept it in the movie.
It works in the movie, but I understand how out of context it is.
Like a trailer is.
Offensive. Yeah.
Totally.
I do think it's interesting. A lot of those complaints, I mean, I think we kind of, you know, really hinted about the twist early on, but I don't think we've explicitly said it.
No, we said it.
Should we? I think, yeah.
Okay, sure.
No?
Whatever.
Oh.
Just say it. Just say
okay.
it.
Blah, no, I'll be vague or whatever. I think that once you have, like, seen, once you know the final context of the film, and again, I went into the film knowing that, which is also why I'm so impressed by it, because I think it really stands up, even knowing the twist, there's still so much suspense of, like, when are things going to be discovered? Even watching with that knowledge, you're just, like, on the lookout for different things. It's a different scary movie experience than I'm sure it would have been if you didn't know what you were watching.
I'm sure it would have been so incredible to have that twist, because you're, like, you're going in, you know this is a creepy kid, you know there's something fucking wrong with Esther, because, like, she's fucked shit for an hour and a half.
And you know it's a horror movie, yeah.
And
I
you
mean...
know it's a horror movie, and you're like, oh, she's just, like, mentally disturbed. Well, yes, but there's more.
But also...
it's giving The Visit, I mean, honestly, I did feel like I had a good base of other movies to draw on watching this as references, like having just done The Visit, having just done Megan, having done Till Death last year with that final scene in both of them. I mean, most of those movies came out after this one, but I felt that they all came together very nicely for me to round out my viewing experience.
It's beautiful. It has so many clear references.
But yeah, but I mean, I think a lot of the things that seem offensive about this movie without context are actually, like, kind of a little bit the movie is trying to subvert in some ways, by having it be someone who is aware of those biases and, like, playing into them.
Yeah, I think also, though, it's, like, adoption is already something that people, like, are iffy about. They're like, oh, I'd never, some people just say, like, oh, I'd never do that or something like that, because they just can't wrap their head around it. And then now there's a whole movie being like, here's a crazy option that could happen if you do it.
Here's which, your,
like,
worst
this would never
case scenario
fucking happen, but you know, you know, if somebody's right on the edge and then they saw The Orphan and who knows.
My family actually tried to adopt kids when I was in eighth grade, and it didn't work because she threatened to kill me in my sleep at the dinner table.
Yeah, I mean,
so, it didn't work out too great.
Oh my
God. When you are dealing with children who have, you know, presumably you can't be in a situation like that without having some trauma, you need a lot of different care and attention, and the level of what a parent can give to that scenario is not gonna be your average person who's ready to just bring home a third child that they birthed at the hospital. Like, it's a totally different deal, and I think that was, like, a lot of the problem that we saw with the parenting in this movie is, like, they automatically expect Esther to be ready to conform to the rules of the household or whatever, and to have, like, the level of trust in them and familiarity with them that a 9-year-old that they had raised for 9 years would have, rather than somebody who just came into their home 2 days ago. Like, I don't know. I mean, it was so weird to me that they were doing, like, mommy, daddy right off the bat, for one. And, like, oh, come inside, meet grandma, blah, blah. Like, I get it that you
I
want
thought
to
that
make
was
this
a
child
lot.
Feel so at home. But it felt like a really strange approach to me.
It
yeah,
was
it
a
was
choice.
Kind of like everything at once, you know, that's kind of going to overwhelm a kid. But, I mean, the realities of it aside, I think they did a really, really good job of, like, pacing, like, the unfolding of the fucked shit that Esther does throughout the film. Like, I think it was really, really good job. They did a good job because at first she's so cherubic, right? Like, she's wearing her cute little dress. She's got her ring curls. She's, like, bonding immediately with Max. She's immediately going so hard trying to learn ASL so she can communicate with her little sister. You know, she's like wants to be under her mommy's tutelage on the piano and all of this stuff. And obviously she's been daddy's little girlfriend the second that they've met. And so kind of so quickly it starts to unravel. And Vera Farmiga is like aware of it right away, but she can't put her finger on it. It's so maddening. Because, like, she does such a good job of manipulating the other little kids around her, you know, and, like, having them be her, you know, sidekicks, in especially Max, making her complicit in her crimes because and threatening the lives of her parents, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I am going to say the twist because I just don't know how to really discuss this movie in a real way without doing it is like, but when you're watching this movie, knowing that she is an adult woman posing as a child and you know the whole time you are not watching a child who has been through fucked up shit, although probably that is also the case, but she's an adult woman now. You're watching an adult person like abuse the children around them. It's a haunting experience. It's a very different, very scary film.
Seriously. No, yeah, it's still terrifying knowing it. It's still terrifying knowing it. I wish that I could erase my mind. This and Signs, or not Signs, this and Sixth Sense, man. That would be beautiful to go back and see it and not know. But yeah, I mean, she just immediately has Max under her fucking finger. And she's so young. I mean, how old is Max supposed to be?
Five.
Like five? Yeah. Oh my God. She's so cute. She's adorable. That actress, she's deaf in real life. And they like scouted her from the street. They like saw her doing sign language like in a parking lot or something. And they're like, there she is.
You. She's a star. You.
I mean, she's the cutest kid I've ever seen. So
she's really
yeah.
good. I think all of the children actors are so good.
Yeah, and there's Jimmy Bennett playing Daniel. I've seen him in so many other things, and I couldn't tell you a single one of them. And now I'm looking at a picture of him as an adult, and it's making me very deeply uncomfortable.
Oh, scary.
I just don't like to think that he's an adult. I just think of him with that hair always. But, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, too, seeing, like, Max embrace Esther so quickly because she's, like, been so interested in the concept of having a sister because her mom used to read her that book about Jessica, her sister who passed away, I guess before she was born, and so she's so excited to have this sister, and just like loves her so much right away.
That was a question I had in my discussion questions, actually. The timeline is so unclear to me because when she's analyzing her dream with her therapist in the beginning, she's saying, like, well, maybe it's not about the stillbirth. Maybe it's about adoption. But in the dream, she says she's there for her third birth. So I just assumed that the Jessica would have been younger than Max. Do we think that's not the case? Or did I mishear whatever you just said?
You misheard what I said.
Oh, never mind.
She was just excited to have a sister. She's an older sister now. I think Jessica would have been her younger sister.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I totally misheard.
Yeah. Jessica would have been her younger sister, but you know, I think she's just so excited about the concept of having a sister at all. You know.
Honestly, that is like interesting to me though about the timeline. Also, knowing that it's a younger sister, because I don't know about you guys. I got this sense from the film, and I could be wrong, so let me know if you got a different sense, or maybe this was obvious, and everybody agrees with me, but I got the sense that her hearing loss was linked to whatever the accident with the pond was, not just that it was, like, she fell through the pond and almost died, but that, like, maybe she got pneumonia or something, and it was like a complication of that, because it's like the brother learning ASL. It could just be that he's a kid and he's like slower to it or whatever, but it seemed almost like a recent ish development, like maybe when she, like 2 years ago, she was three or something like that. You know what I mean? I'm so curious about the timeline of Jessica and then Vera Farmiga's character having an issue with drinking, and then this issue with the pond, and then she's been not drinking for like a year now. I'm so curious.
I know that this is answered in the movie.
Oh.
And I can't remember exactly what she says. Oh my God. Okay, I'm looking up. Hello, listener. I'm looking up the answer to Chelsea's question right now. And I opened up the movie and it starts at the beginning and it's the Warner Brothers logo and it's splattered with black and with the black light paint.
Oh, I love that part.
And the light flickers on and off and you can see the black light paint. And it's like a little like thing
that's
for
fun.
Later in the movie. That's
fun.
Really
fun.
I
like
never
when they
noticed
do that.
That before.
Like they do that. I don't know if it's the same company or whatever, but for Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You, they also have fun with like the opening logo stuff. For the big studio.
I love when they do that kind of shit. It's so fun.
I think so too. Yeah, like have a little fun, do a little branding, a little Easter egg, you know what I mean? I like to commit to the bit, and I like when a movie does that too.
A little. She was born almost completely deaf, and that just allows her to hear enough to read lips. That's a direct quote. So it was not from the accident. She was born with that issue.
Okay. Interesting. That changes my interpretation of her relationship with her brother a little bit, but not in a way that like harms the role that I think it was serving in the movie. Like, I almost think the fact that she always has been deaf and he still is not like not bad at science. I mean, I don't know what level would be developmentally appropriate. But you know, you'd think basic dinner table stuff would be the kind of common usage.
He's being like a 13-year-old boy about it. He's like, he's not interested in like his sister, you know,
sure.
Like that sort of a thing.
He's just being like a big brother with an age gap.
Yeah, I think he's being like a little bit.
I can relate
of
to
a
that.
Fuckboy. Because he's got kind of some, like, we love Daniel, but Daniel's got some, like, fuckboy habits. Okay, I'm not going to talk shit about Guitar Hero because, same, I loved Guitar Hero, but I was really bad at it. So I was jealous that he was really good at
it. That he's whipping Trevor's butt.
Or the fact that he paintballs a pigeon.
I believe him when he says regret, though. Yeah, you can see, I think. I mean, it was not good, but.
He was like, I think that this would be fine. No, that actually, do you know how birds have like hollow bones?
But also like paintballs?
For people of robust size and shape, it hurts too.
Giant bruises because of paintballs.
But he's probably never been hit with a paintball. It looks like he just hits inanimate objects with paintballs. Yeah, so I'm willing to extend grace that this is a lesson he truly is learning for the first time.
But yeah, and then he really learns a lesson.
He feels real bad.
But so here's the thing with Esther. Like, the first couple times, like, you gotta kill this bird. Like, it is the humane thing to do. And she kills it. And I know that's supposed to be foreshadowing. But it's like, no, like, that's accurate. Like, that's what you're supposed to do. And then when she goes to school and Barbara is the child one. Who is naming their kid Barbara? Who has a small child named Barbara in 2009?
Somebody who's a Barbie stan, maybe.
Who named you? But also, like, when she pushes Barbara off the play thing,
watching that. Ugh.
But here's the thing, at that point, you're still kind of on Team Esther, because, like, I would have done that too, you know? Like, you're like, I don't see anything wrong with her actions so far.
If she had actually been a child or an adult.
Well, if you didn't know the twist.
If you didn't know, okay, you would be like, I think they're alarming behaviors for a child, but not anything where you're like, something is wrong with this child. Just like, I think this child needs support.
Right. Like, oh, maybe the child, this Eastern European orphan needs therapy. Oh no.
Yeah.
I was like, maybe in Russia they always put pigeons out of their misery. Okay, I don't know. I have no idea. But I feel like the jungle gym shit felt very premeditated. Just the way that they shot it, I thought was really brilliant. Like how terrified Barbara was just knowing
that she was like out of sight.
Esther was around. She was like peeking around every corner. And like, she pushes her hard, man. And that leg goes snippity snap. The bone breaking shit in this fucks me up.
Yeah. That's one thing I will say about Peter Sarsgaard's character is it is really tricky because we get a lot of implications about why you would not be comfortable or have full trust in Vera Farmiga's like parenting instincts right now. But also he is making a lot of the same mistakes that he would accuse her of making, or that he would like not allow from her, stand for from her. Like that obviously he gets absolutely blasted later in the film, but even just at the playground, he's like smoking a cigarette, walking around, not looking at literally anybody. Like if he heard about something happening while his wife was doing that, I bet you he would be absolutely pissed. But he just like assumes that because he is a quote good parent or whatever, that nothing's going to happen on his watch.
But he is a cheater.
He is a cheater. When he's looking at her boobs and she clocks him, he deserved that. And I liked that we didn't see the conversation. We just heard about the aftermath between Esther and the mom.
Oh, yeah.
That's a deleted scene.
Oh, interesting.
I watched it. It's in the references. Continue, Sydney. Sorry.
These parents are so horny.
They are horny for you. Well, Vera Farmiga struggles a little with her horn. But when she's got it, baby, she's got it.
Dude, that kitchen scene.
Well, the sex scene's like pretty relatable, honestly. You know what I mean? Like giving a blowjob under the blanket, like fun, fresh. Everybody does that, right? And then when they're like fucking on the kitchen and they like hit each other's heads and they're like laughing, I'm just like, yep, that happens. I wouldn't know though, because I am a virgin. I just like assume that would happen, you know?
Sydney's never done sex in her life, actually. I've never done sex.
That's that thing about Sydney.
There is no proof, actually.
There's no proof. I mean, I think I like liked that portrayal of them because I do think that they are two people who like really desperately do want to make it work and like want to have a good, healthy marriage at this point in their lives. And I thought like that it was well played with how she initially turns him down, seemingly just because like her depression and stuff, she's not up to it the first time he's trying, and then she's like, well, now I am up to it, so I'm gonna do something a little silly goofy, and then they don't quite get interrupted by the kids, but then in the kitchen scene, obviously they're super horned up and she's being like, wait, we can't right here, and then she's like, well, actually now I am having so much fun that I would like to do it right here. God, it's got to be hard to be a parent, even under normal circumstances, and be horny for your spouse.
That's why, well, you just have to have a locked laundry room.
Yeah, there needs to be locks on the door.
And just fuck in the laundry room.
Kids aren't going to the laundry room. What kid is doing
the laundry room in my childhood home is between the garage and me, and the garage is where the drinks fridge lives, Sydney. So I gotta go get my little drinkies. That's not a safe place for anybody in my home.
The bedroom door should have a lock on it. No one's allowed to lock their door except for mommy and daddy, so you don't have the traumatizing experience of seeing them fuck. But I will say that there's that classic thing where they're like, oh, like we're having relationship struggles. A baby will fix it. I know this is more complicated than that, but hear me out. The second that they get their baby, aka Esther, they're so horny. And I was like, interesting. I was like, new child equals renewed sex life, like right. Immediately. And I was like, okay, well, but like then, like, you know, as things don't end up being perfect with her when she's acting like a little cherub baby at the beginning, they're like, oh wow, everything's great, our family is whole once more. But then once things start to get complicated, their shit breaks down like right away, and like it's clear that nothing is healed between them from all of the things that have gone down. So I thought that was interesting. But of something that I was thought was cool when I was doing my research, was the little cutie bean who plays Esther. Her name is Isabel Furman, and she's 11 at the time of filming, which I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Let's just give her, like, I don't know, whatever she wants, because she did this movie. Because it's got some pretty heavy content. And yeah, there's something I read that like probably one of the best quotes in the entire movie is after the sex scene that we're talking about, where she walks in on her mom and dad.
Her mommy and her daddy. Yeah.
Full on in the kitchen. And Kate / Vera Farmiga goes in and she's like, hey, so about last night, like when a mommy and a daddy really love each other, and Esther's just like, I know, they fuck. Like, it's so fucking funny. But apparently that scene, they tried to do it in as few takes as possible so they wouldn't make her say the F-bomb so many times, because she had such a sweet little baby.
Because she's 11, Jesus.
But she's so precocious. Like, there's this interview I read with her, and there's a quote to, like, get, because as the movie continues on, she's like acting like a little girl, but like she starts to do more of these like adult mannerisms, like the way that she speaks. She says fuck to Vera Farmiga and she sounds like she knows exactly what that fucking means. Okay, like she's not just repeating the word back that she'd heard. So she said, like, the way that she prepared was, quote, I was observing a lot of people. I was making fun of my mom and her friends while I was watching them. I went to lunch once with Vera Farmiga and we were looking around the restaurant and I was watching these women and they kept looking at me like, why is this person looking at me? And I was just looking at them, how they crossed their legs or tilted their head or how they grabbed for their water. And it all worked out on the day. It just came into place. And I'm like, this little precocious motherfucker, she nailed it. She nailed it when the time comes. And it also kind of creeps me out that she was this child staring at all these full-grown ladies for this period of time being like, and yes, this is how a woman crosses her legs. This is how a woman applies lipstick.
She's a serious
like,
little actress. I mean, good for her. I do think it is fascinating. It's so fascinating to me on a meta level that she was 11 in this film playing a 33-year-old pretending to be a 9-year-old. And then I don't know however old she is now, but I'm assuming like 25 in Orphan First Kill, playing a slightly younger version of her character, playing a slightly younger version of that fake persona.
Like, y'all need to see First Kill. Y'all need to see First Kill.
I mean, after having watched this film, I absolutely am down.
We're watching it together. Watching it together whenever you want. It's an experience.
Yeah, but I
think you might like it better, Sydney.
Ooh.
But I also never know with you. So yeah. You are a mystery to me, and that's what keeps our relationship hot and fresh.
So incredible. Gorgeous.
The only mystery I am is to Monica and my movie preferences.
Yes. I can never fucking guess. I could be so sure and be so wrong.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, I think it is definitely interesting. Again, I watched the film knowing she was an adult, but so I think she does a really fascinating job of like telegraphing that while also believably seeming like a child for so much of it. She must be so talented, or like this was just a well put together job, I think, on that front. But the way they ease into it is really interesting. Like, one of the notes that I wrote down was the scene with Daniel and his two friends in the treehouse when they're like looking at the porno mag. I thought both was a great way of like establishing that hiding spot for later. But also kind of easing you into the weird relationship between children and sex in this movie, and like laid the groundwork for Esther seeing the parents fuck to be alarming and bad and uncomfortable, but not necessarily like sirens going off, you know what I mean? And then obviously it gets even fucking weirder later on in the seduction scene, which we're apparently was again worse, and I'm glad for the power of editing, because I don't know what else it would have been that they cut it down to this. But again, thinking about that scene being played by a real 11-year-old, hate it. Good job, though. Great job.
Yeah, great job.
She did so good. But-
Yeah, and she had this other really interesting quote where she, I'll just read it. She said, "When I read the script, I was thinking about how she feels, Esther, how Esther feels, that she's a victim in a world that doesn't understand her. All she's looking for is love, and she has this dream of a perfect family with a perfect life. She really just wants to be understood. She doesn't think that she's evil. That's the thing. When you look at it from Esther's point of view, it's different. She just wants to find love." Which is such a child version of looking at this, but I also agree with it, kind of. Like, it's hard to parse, like, is Esther actually trying to make it work at first, but then she can't, like, live the lie? Because there seems to be, like, a point where she just kind of, like, gives it up. Where she's like, okay, it's not working on Vera Farmiga. She's not into this. So I'm just going to let it all be known. I am playing a concerto right now. Just to say fuck you to her, which I thought was one of the most hilarious parts of the movie, where Esther's at the piano just playing like the most like Tchaikovsky. I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, like most intense piano thing and just being like, yeah.
Actually, I never said I couldn't do this.
Wanted to make you feel good about yourself, mommy, if you must know.
I thought you wanted a bond, honestly.
I did this for you. Sorry.
Do you want me to teach you, actually?
I do think that's a really interesting question, though, and I am curious that you are posing it, since I would imagine there's slightly more information about this in First Kill, but maybe there's not, or maybe you're protecting...
I'm not gonna say. We're talking okay. about this movie.
That's true. But I do think it's interesting, because on IMDb trivia, it talked about how in the script, I think there was a like elaborately fleshed out backstory for her. And I hated that. And I think
I hated it too.
Yeah, you can see the evidence of it in the film, but I appreciated that I watched the film without it, because I don't think that you needed it. And I like it more as a question, because I think, first of all, it would be a great scam if you can pass for a child and are willing to do childhood again, to actually just delay adulthood for a long time and be somebody else's responsibility. That sounds great, really? I think.
Rent is expensive, guys. I want to be a child again.
Exactly.
I agree. I totally agree. The other thing, though, that makes me... when I first watched this, I'm like, she is just doing this as a ploy so she can get to these fathers and try to fuck them and then kill everyone or something. Like, that's what
I think my first read
of this was, right? Uh-huh. But then when you think about her freakouts, it's really interesting, because she has these, like, I don't know, panic attack episode things throughout the film a couple of times. Like, one when... Barbara tries to touch her ribbon around her neck, which I love that little reference to the green ribbon, just saying.
Yeah.
That was wonderful. And that was self-preservational, right? She's like, you can't, if you take this off,
don't ruin my scars.
They will know.
Yeah, they'll be like, what the fuck? But the other one that was really interesting is when it is right after the therapy session with that therapist, and she goes into the bathroom and she's by herself, and she's like leaning against the wall, and she's like, she doesn't know she didn't see. She doesn't know she didn't see. Like, she didn't see me. She didn't see through what I was doing. And she was like freaking out about it. And it's just like, it's just an interesting reaction, if like that she's this like villain, you know, because she's fucking scared, she's fucking freaking out.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I don't know, it could be both, though.
I unfortunately
want to make it work.
The backstory is a very compelling psychological motivation for all of her actions. That said, I like it if she's just kind of a little freak.
We should just say what the backstory was, so they know what we're talking about. Also, I forgot what it is.
Disgusting to me.
She is actually from Estonia, and Vera Farmiga found her Bible, I think, that she had hidden, that had the name of something.
The Sarn Institute.
Yes. And so she Googled it, and it was like, she calls them up, and she's like, we're actually in Estonia. This isn't an orphanage. This is an institution. Can you tell us? And so she emails a picture
right,
to the people.
Yeah. but there is this other Sydney, there's this other background story that's like not in the movie where it explains like her childhood, and it's super fucked up. And I read it, but I did not put it in my notes because I never wanted to look at it again.
But it was
like about like bad things that happened to her as a child.
Yeah, it was like she was sexually abused by her own biological father when she was young. And so she's kind of like recreating that relationship with all of these adopted fathers along the way, which is what's really fucked up about the seduction scene, because she's not revealing. It's not like she needed to use the premise of being a child to get close to this adult man and then reveal herself to him as an adult woman. She is seducing him still in little girl form, just sexy. It's like before she's taken off the makeup and like unbound her chest and everything, like she is still presenting to them as the way that she presented as their adoptive daughter. She's just in a sexy outfit now, which is so haunting. Weird. And it's upsetting. So haunting.
Like, I read that and I was like, okay, fair. That makes a lot of sense. But also, fuck you. Fuck you. How dare you? I hate you. You made the movie less fun. Now I feel sad.
Yeah. Which is why I'm glad it's not in the sad listener. Yeah. I mean, again, I do think it's a really compelling backstory. Makes a lot of sense. It works well for the film. I'm glad it wasn't in the film because I liked the tone of the film without it.
Totally. Totally. And I will say that First Kill also does not bring that up. So yeah. Don't worry.
I mean, while we're talking about cut things, though, there was just a lot of stuff like that, including another scene where originally in the beginning, they were there to adopt a specific different little girl named Yolanda. And Esther like met them while they were there to visit Yolanda, and then like when they're supposed to come get Yolanda, Esther got to her first, it's implied, and then so they adopt Esther instead. I thought,
oh, do they kill Yolanda? Does she kill Yolanda?
Yeah, like Yolanda sound like dead on the premises, basically. And
wow.
It's like,
oh, I kind of like that, but it kind of would have been too much too soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think they needed to ease you into it. And I also think that like they want to leave you not sure of your suspicions for a little longer with what's happening. Obviously, you know, it's kind of like The Visit, where it's like, is this someone where this is sad, or is this someone where this is wild? And it's if wild. You know too much from the beginning, it like sways what you're thinking of the film. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. And it also really like that you get that information still, essentially the same thing from the nun.
Sister Abigail?
Who is such a great. Yeah, she's such a great character in this. Like, she comes by and she's like, actually, now that I'm putting two and two together, I am getting four. And
now that I have
Esther
a little more information
around when a lot of fucked shit has happened. She's just been like standing 2 feet away, like, ooh, me in my little dress. And I, oh man, I mean, we haven't talked about the nun at all. There's another deleted scene though that relates to the nun's death. The Sister Abigail.
That death was fucking wild, by the way.
It's so wild.
That was the moment where I was like, damn.
Sacrifices Max. She straight up sacrifices Max's life. She's like, she could die. I don't care. Either way, it'll be fine. I don't know how her plan will work if Max is dead, though. Just saying.
Maybe she hopes. I mean, I think it would be a different film and a different plan. But at that point in watching the film, I was like not prepared for her to be eliminating the competition for the parents' attention and affection. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and she keeps doing that later on. But I mean, she just beats the shit out of her with a hammer. She beats the ever-loving shit out of her.
The gore was so horrifically done in a way that I think was good and
good.
Upsetting
it
to me.
It is a horror movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's rated R.
It was both like shocking and I thought well put together. I thought they struck just the right tone for it, basically. I also thought it was interesting, per IMDb, that this the role of Sister Abigail was, like, written for that actor, CCH Pounder. It was written with her in mind.
What a great name.
I mean, it is a great name. I love a CCH.
Yeah, no, she bodied this. She was so good. And, yeah, I mean, it just the depth of the manipulation that she puts on Max in that moment is crazy. Because Max is fucking terrified. Like, she can't communicate with anyone else in the situation because no one else is, if someone comes by, they're not going to know ASL. So it's mm-hmm. a whole other thing. And then, like, she's just like, you're a part of this now. And as much as I'll get in trouble, you're going to get in trouble. And you're fucking 5 years old. So you have no clue if that's true or not. And you're going to believe her. So, like, oh my God.
Those were the moments that were so fucked up to me, too, where when you're like, this is an adult woman doing this, where she's like, she knows exactly what to say to make this child feel responsible. Both for the bad thing that happened and also feel like indebted to this other person that's saying, like, I love you, I'm gonna take care of you, I won't let anything happen to you, I'm protecting you from this punishment, actually, but she that only existed because I put you in that situation. Sides. Yeah, I mean,
it's wild. She's good at it.
They're both incredible little actresses. I think the way that Max's deafness was used in this movie was amazingly done. I mean, she's a real deaf actress, which we've mentioned, but I went looking and I found like a message board and another blog, but from someone who's a British sign language user, so they were like, I can't speak to the sign language itself, but people seem to be like very happy with this from a representation standpoint, like it was done relatively like well and responsibly. And I also just think the plot narrative purpose that it serves, the way that it plays in, is so well done. It's so scary when they take away the sound when she doesn't have her cochlear implants in. It's like so effective and incredible when they use it at the end when she's like hiding for her to like not know what's going on or where things are or what has happened and hasn't happened, like
pot.
She can't hear that her mom is there at the house, you know what I mean? Like, I thought it was so well used.
It was brilliantly used. And it made me really interested in that movie Hush, because I still have never seen it. And I know that that's a big part of it, but I do not know if they did as good of a job with that. It's like about a deaf woman and a home intrusion. So I don't know if that was a fucked up portrayal, but I've heard a lot of great things about it. And I was like, I really am interested in this concept. Like, it's so effective and so well done in this that if they did it well on the scale of a whole film, I'd be really interested in it.
It's interesting because they did A Quiet Place, obviously, also has a deaf actress playing a deaf character, and that's like very central to that film as well. There was that one Jane Levy one also where the guy whose home they break into, but they're the main characters, the breaker-inners, called Silence. That one's fucked up.
I think he's blind.
I think you're right, actually. Anyway.
He's blind, yeah. Anyway, but, I mean, from there... Oh, sorry. Back to the things that are cut out just really quickly. Apparently, there was this whole subplot where she fucking frames a homeless person for killing...
Yeah! So glad that's not in this. What? So glad that's not in this.
I started getting to those deleted scenes. Like, I was watching the compilation of deleted scenes, and I was like, I don't even want... Just don't even tell me.
Yeah.
But they are linked in the references if you are interested. But yeah, I mean, like, from there, I mean, the auntie is so upped because she has to cover up her acts right away. Esther does. And Daniel starts to sort of see what's going on. Sees her hide something up in the treehouse. And you get that amazing scene where she threatens to cut off his little peen.
That's scary.
That's so scary. Oh, my God. I mean, and from then, she's got everybody under her thumb. Like, she's got
both
dirt
kids
on Max. Because Max thinks that she's going to go to jail for murder as a 5-year-old.
And she also knows that this is a person who's willing to push her in front of a moving car, even if she's not going to send her to jail for murder.
Yes.
Totally. Yeah. And it it gets to this point where, like, exactly what you're saying, she is trying to start eliminating the competition at this point, because she's like, these people both know too much about me, so I need to get rid of them so it can just be me and mommy, but daddy, mostly daddy. I think the car scene.
That part. Oh, my God.
Because she just does such a good job of turning everyone against Vera Farmiga, because she knows so much about what's gone on. She knows about her past. She knows about her drinking. She knows about the incident where Max almost drowns in the pond. Like,
because she read her journal.
People don't trust her. Yeah, it's fucked up. And she's also always fucking listening.
She's like quoting from the journal.
Yeah. But that part, it's such a brilliant way to make Vera Farmiga look like she's got no fucking clue what's going on. Like, no park break on that hill, honey?
In the snow? Yeah,
In the snow?
It was fascinating to read IMDb trivia and see that this movie was originally supposed to be set in the fall, and they even had, like, a Halloween scene planned. But because there was, like, a lot of unexpected...
Able to do it for winter vibes.
Yeah, I mean, crazy for us. There was unexpected snow, like, when they were going to film. So they were like, okay, I guess we'll make this a winter movie. But I think the winter aspect of it is used so well, both for, like, the final scene on the frozen pond at the end, which you're, like, waiting to pay off the whole time. And also with the car scene, because you have the stress of it, but ultimately when it crashes into a big snowbank. And so, like, it's okay. Everybody is safe. But you've now upped the stakes of, like, can Vera Farmiga be trusted to her family? Like, especially with the wine bottle reveal, like, right after. Because she read in her journal where she hides her wine bottles. damn.
This is why
she got her ass.
I don't keep a journal. No one can know.
Damn.
All
she
the
really
stay up here in the noggin.
Keep your secrets to yourself. No, it's actually so healthy for you to write in a journal, but... No, yeah, I mean, hopefully nobody
really
finds it.
I really liked it when I was doing journaling. So.
Yeah, it's so good for you. And I don't do it. I probably never will, but I bet it would be a relief.
But for somebody else,
for someone else, I really recommend it. Yeah.
Oh my God. But yeah, I mean, and what's the fucking context for the Daniel part? Oh yeah, Daniel finally gets Max to admit something to her about what the fuck is going on. And it's that there's some evidence of the crime in that.
In the hidey hole.
Treehouse. Such a cool treehouse.
Such a cool treehouse.
It has like two stairs. Terrifying.
I loved it. The landings, like, for to connect the staircase. Gorgeous. Loved it. I mean, I think that I don't think they ever said the word architect in the film, but you do see Peter Sarsgaard, like, carrying blueprints at one point, which I thought was great, because immediately went, like, oh, of course, that's why their house is so beautiful and also remote or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it makes total sense, even if they never say it, like, it's there enough. And also, of course, this architect built his children this banging fucking treehouse. It rules.
It rules so hard. Oh, but that, God, she's also just like, she's so good at being evil
bad.
Or whatever you want to call it. Bad. She's so good at being bad.
She's so good at being
bad.
I
mean, like, she thinks it through so well. Like, she backs him into a corner, lights the fire, so he lights on fire, locks him into
the fucking thing. Squirts him with the lighter fluid.
Squirts him
Damn.
With the lighter fluid. Like, and, oh my God, it's almost a perfect plan, but you can't. And I also like that she was going to kill him like a pigeon.
Yeah.
Like, she was fully going to kill him like
Rock
a pigeon.
Up, ready to smash.
Yeah, and then, I mean, the hospital scene right after that, it's just
the way she puts the thingy on her own finger, so smart.
Yes, because I didn't get that. I forgot that happened this time, and I think I looked away the 1 second that she did that, and I was like, oh, the heartbeat, like, is, like, getting a little bit faster, but it's because
she's
killing her.
She's exhilarated.
Exhilarated, yeah. Oh, my God. And so when I first watched this movie, and, like, up until yesterday when I rewatched it, I fully thought that Daniel actually died. And this was, like, the bleakest shit that anyone had ever seen. Because this ending's pretty fucking bleak, okay? Like,
I think they played around with that idea. I'm glad they didn't commit to it. I'm so
glad. Yeah, he was supposed to die. But he's alive.
He is. Yeah. They say on the phone at one point, he says on the phone, don't worry about Darren. Or when she's in the hospital and she has just like woken up after she needed to be sedated after attacking Esther. And of course sedated her after that. Although fascinating to see that she wasn't put on like an involuntary hold. They just like sedated her and were going to keep her overnight. Yeah. I mean, I don't really know what the deal was with that, but there are certain things in this movie plot hole wise that you kind of just have to overlook and be like, it's fine.
Like how she was just able to leave the hospital and cops weren't called after she assaulted a child.
Yeah, and like how Esther got her broken arm set without any other medical treatment revealing any pinkiness that she was trying to hide.
Oh my god, we totally skipped that part.
That part is
how
so fucked
that
up.
She cuts all the flowers off of the baby tree. That is terrible. Oh my god.
Well,
but that's
really
the part where I had to pause.
Those are roses, and so honestly,
they will regrow,
and they grow better. They always say, like, every season you're supposed to like chop roses down. So they always say, men do better with roses than women do because women don't want to chop them down. They're like, no, it's so pretty, and men are just like, fuck this shit, chop, 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 and then they grow so much better.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I don't blame her for fucking freaking out. I don't know if I would have had quite so violent a reaction, but again, this, I am not a mother.
Not an experience I've had. But I could imagine her in that moment feeling as though she has lost her child for a second time.
And there's like so much stuff that's led up to this moment. She knows Esther's been lying to her. She's been doing weird things. Barbara broke her fucking leg. The fact that part when she uses the fucking
clamp thing
to break her own arm, that's when I had to pause. I had to pause for like 2 minutes and like be like, it's gonna be okay, it's gonna be fine. And it still was not that great when I saw it with my eyes.
I mean, again, that's another one of those things where it's this speed of the movie does a lot there, because that's like back to back with other stuff happening, you know what I mean, for the most part. Because if they had really been like investigating that, I mean, if you are grabbing someone hard enough to break their arm like that, the bruises would be like fingerprint shapes. They wouldn't be like flat presses clamp. Like from that clamp.
Well, probably the dad didn't want to like
look
get
at all
CPS called on his wife at this time.
Maybe that lady from the park who wanted him to move the chair is a doctor, and he had her look at it off the books and just throw that brace on there instead of a full ass cast.
They probably just bought the brace at Walgreens.
Maybe that too, honestly.
Himself. He's an architect. It's fine. Right?
He's basically a doctor.
It's the same thing.
But yeah, I mean, there are things like that where I think like you get enough from the movie that you don't really question it, and you don't really need it to make actual narrative logic sense in the real world. But you do have to overlook it once you're thinking about it a little bit more and just go, whatever, it's fine.
I'm fine with overlooking it. I think like this is pretty fucking cohesive on the whole with what the time that they had allotted. But I just think the final whole sequence of this, the grand finale, is so awesomely intense, because you've got the back and forth of what's going on with the dad at home. And you know that she's like taking the cochlear implant, so Max can't hear shit of what's going to happen. So you know something bad's going down. And then you get Vera Farmiga waking up to these voicemails and these phone calls. And he's like, if you don't get to your husband now, they're dead.
Yeah.
It's just.
Okay. But this is where she's like, you know, she was so violent, we had to keep her in a straitjacket. Like, you would see all her scars, and they were like, we never saw scars. And that's where the ribbon and the bracelet is. And I have the family straitjacket.
Your life experiences are so hauntingly relevant to this film, Sydney.
I cannot believe you have the family straitjacket with you now.
Who else in the family needs a straitjacket but me? But look, you got little like hands, and then this goes, and it, so you're like,
But and so was it like the neckline was cutting into her neck, I guess?
Yeah, so it was so tight. Although I don't know how, what maybe...
Well, I don't think you can do it yourself by design, you know?
No, you. I can't do it, but I'm just trying to think, like, look, what on the wrist? Maybe they had other stuff.
They probably had wrist restraints, too. I don't know. Or maybe she wasn't always in a straight jacket. Maybe sometimes it was just...
Maybe like, it had little half sleeveys where, like, right. half of it was open so she could use her hands, but then the other half had little... belts and buckles or whatever so that they could be secure.
I love that you brought out the family
a visual aid.
And they have, hold on, it's hard to pick things up.
Yeah, this I bet like, it is.
This goes like in between your legs, so it's like fully secure. So you can't
wiggle out of it that way.
Yeah. Oh my God. Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, one of her, the movies that Isabel Furman allegedly studied for this film was Silence of the Lambs. And Anthony Hopkins' performance in that. So, you know, she's clocking what being in a straitjacket is like.
Mm.
Oh, but yeah, I mean, that scene originally when she wakes up in the hospital is when he says, like, oh, Daniel's fine or whatever. But then the whole reveal on the dad's part from being, like, totally blasto and, like, originally brushing off this seduction moment to then, like, cluing in once and then kind of backing off from it and then eventually cluing back in again when it is like truly unavoidable, that existed and was well done, but I don't need to discuss it.
It when was he goes so upstairs, well done, but it was so like makes me want to yak a little.
So barfy,
myself.
Yeah, totally barfy. When he goes upstairs and there's the black light scene. Oh my god, it is so
god.
Fucking. It's such a banger. I mean, I think a black light scene is always fun. They did some of that in Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. They did that in that lesbian movie we did for Pride 2 years ago, What Keeps You Alive. Yeah, thank you. It was so fun in that movie. It was so unbelievably cool in this film. She is Esther, Lena, whatever her name is. She is an incredible creative.
She's an amazing artist. She has an amazing style. And
there's so many
different
mediums.
Just selling her porn paintings online. That's how she could support herself.
I was not expecting to see a blacklight photo of her being fingered.
She did a great job.
It was incredibly accurate. Can Very you? Talented. Oh my god! And he's
hey, that's
like,
a through line from last week. Bring back fingering.
Bring back fingering 2023, dude. Straight up, the most. Can you imagine? I just can't imagine being like. This is a person who he doesn't know still that this is an adult woman.
He never knows.
So to his death, he thinks a child has painted a porn of them having a time.
He also realizes it's not just that, although that is certainly memorable and really makes an impression. The basic aspect of seeing her drawings that she's tacked up on the walls and the blacklight additions that are only visible under UV that really bring those innocent drawings to life in a very sinister, spooky, murdery, vicious way. That's so cool. Her vision. Be an artist,
so cool.
Esther. Oh my god, the money people would pay. You're so talented, girl.
Seriously. Oh, it's super. Yeah, there. It's a really cool part of First Kill, like that theme in it. So it's really really fun. But yeah, it's
the dad scene though.
The dad. Oh my god. Like, see, I just, like, I'm so used to watching scary movies that aren't that scary. So, like, I was like, no one's going to really die, like, in a family horror. No, he's dead. He's dead so hard. He's dead immediately. He gets dead so fast. He's got so many stabs. That's a lot of stabs. You don't come back from that. It's right in the heart.
Yeah.
It's over.
And again, things that didn't happen for 1,000, Alex. But an original version of this scene, it was going to be like a lot more elaborate, and she was going to like catch him in her bedroom upstairs and like break his leg at some point or whatever, and then like hang him with a jump rope. It was gonna be like a whole thing, which I think, you know, would be perfectly in place for something for Megan to do to someone. But I loved that in this movie they were just like, no, Esther does not need to do that. She's honestly not really about the flash of it in that aspect. She's pretty utilitarian when it came to the action amongst her art is different than her survival instincts.
Well, and also there's the whole thing with like the knife and penetration. Sorry to say that word right now, but it's true. like she's just
it's real.
Oh, you just like said no to my advances. Fuck you. I'm gonna fuck you with this knife.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be elaborate and drawn out and like scary and all the different things that can happen. The fact that it is just 500 stabs is terrifying.
And it rips the carpet out from under you because you know that Vera Farmiga is on her way. She's trying to save him no matter what. But, like, it's already done. He's already dead. Not that she's only going there for him because she's also got her sweet baby girl there as well. But, like, she gets there and immediately is confronted. Like, the first thing she sees after crashing her car into the living room is her fucking dead-ass husband. He's dead. There's nothing you can do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. God, oh my God. And like, for again, all the troubles that they have in their relationship and that they've had in this film, that scene after Esther says they fuck or whatever, and they're like, well, you fucking spend some time with her. All right, bitch. Like, they're very cute and funny together in these spare few moments where we get them just being them. You know what I mean? Like, you, for everything that happens, like, you do see the love that they had for each other and, like, the potential of them to have figured things out in a different universe.
No, it's devastating. It's devastating. And it's just, it also sucks because, like, she was right. She was right that this person, there was something up. And, like, of course, no one believed her because of many reasons, but also because it's an outlandish thought that, like, this child is evil. But she's like, I was right, and I tried to stop this, and I tried so hard 4 weeks, 4 months, and no one cared, and no one listened, and now it's too late, you know? It's super sad. Ugh.
Yeah. I think that's what's tough about horror movie husbands sometimes is it's so often a horror movie husband not believing his wife, and you kind of want him. I mean, we've talked about it here, where it's like, if you don't believe me, like, you better believe me. We kind of want, as an audience, a lot of times to see the husband who does not believe his wife that something is wrong. We want to see them get their comeuppance. This is so cold. It doesn't feel
It beyond.
Feels deserved within the logic of the film. Like, it feels like, yeah, that's what happened. That's the natural consequence of what.
Sad
but like
ending.
Yes, it's sad. You're sad. You're
no
not
matter
like he
what,
got
even
his.
At this point. You're like, there's 15 minutes left in the movie, and like one of the worst things that could happen has already happened. So they better not fucking kill Max. I swear to fuck.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the final like chase scene, fight scene, whatever, is super epic. But here's the thing: we already talked about the like silence part, so we've done that. The thing is, there's two endings, and there's a whole video of it linked in the references, so you can watch it. But so like they could have shaved 15 minutes off the movie if they had gone with the ending that they didn't go with. But I think it would have fallen a little flat, and especially after what we just discussed, how the dad gets ding dong dead right away, you kind of want that comeuppance for Esther, because the alternative ending is that Vera Farmiga goes thump and falls on her and smooshes her up, whatever, grabs Max, runs out of the house, and then the police come, and Esther does not come after Vera Farmiga and Max. Instead, she picks her ass up. She walks back upstairs. She sits down in front of mommy's vanity. And she puts makeup on over all the cuts and the blood and the shit on her face. And she gets dressed back up in her cute little baby girl white cherub dress. She puts her little ribbons back on. And when the police come, she walks down the stairs and says, "Hi, I'm Esther." And that's the end of the movie.
Ew.
I know. It was cool to watch.
I mean, it sounds interesting and, like, good potential sequel bait or kind of a good potential whatever at the time. And, like, reading the IMDb description of that, I was like, okay, that is interesting. That is an interesting potential ending for her to be, like, playing innocent again for the police. And, you know, it's kind of the interesting conundrum of we've obviously seen what's happened, but who are they going to believe?
Yeah.
But they also had another potential ending that I don't think they even filmed, but allegedly in the script where, like, the final showdown was just going to be in the house and Vera Farmiga's character was going to shoot Esther with the gun. I don't know how they could have ever planned to do anything differently than the final showdown at the pond when the pond has been so lurking in the background this whole thing. It's Chekhov's pond. Oh, no. You know what I mean? They had to go back to the
pond.
It's
Chekhov's pond. Well, they bring it all back, and I also love that little Max. It's so fucked up, but I love that she tries to shoot Esther. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, I loved it too.
Yes, girl, fucking shoot her. She's been fucking with you for months.
She pointed that gun right in her fucking face so early on in the movie. She just didn't have an appreciation yet for the fact that that was real.
Yes, she was like, straight up, we're going to play roulette right now. Like, that's why she's like, oh, Esther's so unhinged. And it's just like, yes, it's been done, but yes, it's another reference to a film that we love, The Ring. When you get Vera Farmiga fucking kicking Esther in the face, saying, I'm not your fucking mommy, like, straight up. That's amazing.
That was gonna be the thing in the film. She was gonna say that line and then shoot her. I think the kick in the face is way better because it's more fun, for one, and because it's like more desperate.
Yeah,
it's more like visceral than just shooting someone. I do think it is interesting,
the theme of bone breaking throughout the film.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. I think it is interesting that this scene with the greenhouse where Vera Farmiga has to, like, drop in on her from the glass and is, like, trying to sort of watching from above versus the falling through the ice, like, those are kind of very similar, like, literally waiting for the shattering point moments on both of them. But it didn't feel repetitive to me watching the film, which is super interesting, I think. Like, I think they didn't work against each other, even though they're kind of doing a very similar thing of this, like, literally something's about to break between the two of them in their showdown, and Max is here and in danger and on the periphery, and does she get involved, does she not get involved. I thought the way that they did it was great, and also them to use the sign language in that moment where she's communicating to her through the greenhouse windows so that they can communicate even though they can't, like, literally speak to each other on the other side of the glass. And then when Max is, like, trying to help in the pond and she's like, no, like, literally do not come onto the ice. Even if I am falling into the ice and drowning, I am demonstrating my care as a mother in this moment, being like, literally get back, because I still have ice pond trauma. I don't know. I thought it was great. I thought the ending
rules. No, it was
an
epic ending. It was epic. Truly epic.
And then it cut to the first credit. The director, don't know how to say his name. Does anybody know how to say his name? I feel like we researched it when we did a different movie of his, but I recognized his name immediately and I went, we've covered something that he's done. What have we covered that he's done? And I went and I checked, and when I saw it was House of Wax, I went out loud, like, I was like,
yes,
when I saw that.
I saw that in my, yes, no, it makes sense to me, because, like, House of Wax also has some, like, fucking visceral nasty shit in it that I was like, all right, you're a sick fuck, I love you, man whose name I cannot pronounce.
Is it
Dom Zhao?
I'm gonna Google it real quick.
Kole Sarah. I don't know how to do French. Kole Sarah feels right, but I don't even know what to do with a J in French.
Okay, I think it is Yama Colette Sarah. The video that I found was someone seeing somebody introducing him at like a convention or something. So they could have gotten it wrong also, but he waved. So
iconic. He's an iconic man and I love him.
Mm-hmm. He's good at his job. Although I didn't love The Shallows when I watched it, but it was not a film that I gave my full and direct attention to from start to end. I paused it a lot.
You could give it another try.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love a shark movie, so I'm open.
Well, that brings us to our segments. So we must ask, how could this movie have been gayer?
I have something I would like to say.
Go.
I got gay vibes from Esther/Lena's different presentations in the film. I would love to discuss that. I think it is so interesting that it was very much her choice to wear the little Victorian doll dresses for so much of the film. And then do her like sexy strapless black dress look for the seduction. And then when she gave up the goat to be wearing like the black off the shoulder top and jeans, it's giving me this is not a direct comparison, but what it's giving me is like, some days you're a little mask and some days you're a little femme. You know what I mean? Some days you're like wearing like skater boy style. And then some days you're doing like the full beat makeup, dressed to the nines, etc.
Multitude.
Yeah. Baby. It just gives me like different queer, expression is what I get from her, because I think she's really committed to both looks. And I love that she's not willing to compromise or like do something in the middle. It's like one or the fucking other, baby.
Mm-hmm. Pick your poison.
There's obviously like narrative purposes to the baby doll dresses, and like maybe she's just decided that is like what is her best disguise. But she's really fucking committed to the twee look. You know what I mean? Vera Farmiga starts to be like, don't you want to wear something that won't get you bullied? And she goes, this is my fucking outfit, bitch. So.
As another, from one twee bitch to another, go ahead, girl. Okay, wear the beret. Uh-huh. That beret fucking slaps, by the way. I need a beret that's got the little like beading or like rhinestones around the bottom. Amazing. I also feel like there could be a silver lining to the very, very sad ending, where maybe Vera Farmiga has a late to lesbian awakening now that her husband has been brutally murdered by a child presenting 32-year-old woman. Yeah, I don't know. That could be something for her. I just feel like,
There's something there, you know?
It there's something there.
Vera Farmiga has so much gay potential.
She kissed someone in college.
That,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I whenever she wants to give me more of that content in film and movies, I'll eat it right up.
Yeah. Also, this is just a side note. Apparently, she's actually, like, really fucking good at the piano. And there was going to be more of her playing the piano in the movie, and they cut it out, and she was really mad.
Yeah, well, because the part that she's playing and, like, writing in the beginning allegedly, like, is her actual composition that she was doing, like, for the character's children. But she was, like, putting that together. And it didn't even make the deleted features or whatever, allegedly. And she was like, not even the bonuses, not even the extras.
Not even on the DVD.
Yeah. Bummer for her. We don't know that it was. I don't want to say anything about her skills on the record, actually. I would never want to say anything.
Do not talk ill about Vera.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. I would never.
I'm sitting right here. How dare you? I don't know. I don't necessarily get like a gay vibe from Daniel, you know? So
sure.
He just seems like a straight boy.
He's really into
the porno data this time.
I can see that for Max.
I can see that from Max.
I also think, a lot of nuns become nuns for whatever internal
big
reasons
gay
they
vibes
have.
From the nun.
Oh,
big
yeah.
Gay vibes. Yes, that's fully there. That's fully there. Also, Dr. Browning, something to be said. Sister Abigail and Dr. Browning, I wish they could have met. But also, Dr. Browning, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Not very perceptive, are you?
Margot Martindale, noted character actress, or whatever the whole BoJack Horseman line about her is. But, I mean, she is incredible, and she's done so much.
Oh, yeah. She's great. I loved seeing her in this, but I was also like, girl.
Her character should never have been the therapist for all of them. It happens, but it feels like lots of conflict of interest at play.
Yeah.
But she pissed me off, so.
Yeah, she pissed me off. See, now you know how I felt with fucking whatever from Megan.
Sure.
Anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Lydia.
Lydia. Okay, are we ready to move on to Matthew Lillard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where would Maddie be in this great, incredible film? I don't want him to be the dad because I don't want him to have to go through that.
Yeah,
but I would like to see him in a whole movie. Dad.
Yeah, I mean, you could easily throw his picture in as one of the pictures in the Bible of all the previous dads. You know what I mean? When it's revealed, it's not just this one dad. There's lots of dad photos in there. He could have been one of them.
Many dads.
Or he could have been that nurse. That the Estonian nurse who spoke English the first one and not like the actual doctor. I would love to hear Matthew Lillard do an Estonian accent.
That'd be beautiful.
That'd be fun.
I'd love that. I would love that. There's not like a lot of options.
He could have been another dad in the background at the playground or something. You know, I mean, there are lots of things where you could like throw him in as just like an Easter egg.
Or
he would have bodied this, though.
Fun fact, going back to our previous segmento, instead of a mom coming up to flirt with him, it could have been a dad, and that dad could have been
Matthew Lillard.
That would have been so awesome.
Yeah, I love that.
Yes, that's the answer. We've found the answer. And so that leads to who is the dumb bitch of this movie? And it could be the therapist, but it could also be John.
And I think it's the nuns for not doing enough research onto this child.
Absolutely no due diligence into really? This child's
they
origins.
Let this couple have the child also.
They're but presumably also they were like not doing any kind of like social work therapy interventions at the group home either. They're just like, this child doesn't want to interact with any of the other children, and she has witnessed all of these terrible accidents, but it's fine, probably. No further questions. Excuse you?
Also, when they call, and they're like, you know, we are going to need her doctor and dental records from
why is
you.
It, yeah,
like,
why is it their responsibility?
Why didn't you do that? Like, why didn't you take her to the dentist? Why
they should have, the yeah. I mean...
He probably manipulated her way out of it for long enough, because that's got to...
Sure?
It's like... imagine your teeth always being in your body and they could give you away at any moment.
Yeah.
Where'd she get the baby dentures, by the way? Here's the question.
Flippers are something that they use in like beauty pageants for like babies.
Maybe she got them with her last family.
She's got baby teeth.
Or I guess you would have seen
that.
We'll
have to watch
First
Kill to find out.
Maybe she got,
imagine there being a whole teeth plot line. I don't remember. There could be. I don't know.
I believe you.
And this is where I got my dentures with my last family. I mean, that would still have given her away then. I don't know. But anyway. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of options for dumb bitch here. I think that the therapist is one of them. But it's hard to say. She's so good at it. She's a master manipulator.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to give it to any one person with the level of intrigue and manipulation that's going on in this movie, obviously. This is actually probably not the appropriate time to mention it, but I haven't mentioned it so far. I did want to see more from the grandma, and it's not that she really had dumb bitch potential per se, but I was disappointed the way that she was barely present, and when she was, she didn't factor into the plot at all, and then I expected her to be part of the plot
bitch,
at the end.
She left.
Yeah, I really thought that
she was
going to be more competition for the dad's attention. You know what I mean? I thought she would be at the house with them, other than I'll give it to her for
there
the
to
thing
be
at
a
the
cunt and reveal the lake thing. That's why she was there.
Yeah, but I'll give it to her dumb bitch nomination at the very least for the part in the hospital. Why are you letting a child wander off in the hospital anyway? Don't do that.
She wants to undermine Vera Farmiga.
She does.
She is literally like, your mother says you have to stay here. Here you
She's
go.
A dumb bitch.
I think she deserves
She's
it then.
Bitch.
Yeah, actually, that
she
was the perfect
it.
Segue. And I am so smart and I thought of it on purpose.
Genius. She's the dumb bitch. Okay, that brings us to our knives out of fives. And I actually am curious to see what the critical reception was to this movie at the time.
It...
All the other times I don't care, apparently. No, I just particularly
wow!
care this time.
How dare
this
you?
This one time I actually care.
On IMDb, it got a 7.0 out of 10. On Rotten Tomatoes, it got 58% from critics, which is rotten. But it got 63% fresh from audiences, which is fresh. It did win Isabel Furman, an actress from like a horror festival, that I put in my notes, but I don't remember what it was at this time. But she won best, oh, it was at the 2009 Fright Meter Awards. She won best actress. This film was also notably nominated for a 2019 Choice Award, for Choice Summer Movie Drama. So,
nice.
You know, kind of a mixed reception numbers wise, but did get some real critical acclaim. But not from critics, just from the awards shows, I guess. The super important ones, like the Teen Choice Awards.
Yeah, no, that's very, it's very boring.
Also, very boring. Did you know that this movie is produced by Leonardo DiCaprio?
I did, actually, because thank you for bringing it up. There's what something the in IMDb fuck? Trivia where, first of all, it says this seemed like, I don't know if it's true, but it seemed like great hot goss to me that Vera Farmiga and Peter Sarsgaard weren't so sure about taking these roles, but Leonardo DiCaprio had a vested interest in this film being successful, so he pressured them into taking the roles, or they felt pressured into taking the roles. Again, don't know if that's true, but I was like fascinating goss. And then also it said that the part at the end where Esther Lena is like slipping away and the frozen water was a direct parallel to Jack at the end of Titanic.
That's so
thank you so
funny.
Much for bringing that up, because I love that trivia and I forgot about it.
That is, wow. How sweet of Leonardo to add that in. How beautiful. We love an homage to the Titanic in this 2009 horror movie about an orphan. Oh my God.
So funny.
Wow. His influence. Incredible.
So real.
Mm-hmm. James Cameron at it again.
Oh, something else, a very interesting piece of trivia to me, was when I read that per the Estonian birth certificate or whatever, the documents that they have at some point in the film, it says that Esther's birthday is April 20th. And I went, haha, that's 420. And then it said that's also Hitler's birthday. And I went, oh my God. And then I had to process the fact that Hitler's birthday is 420. So now you all have to as well.
You're learning so many things.
It was a real whirlwind of one tiny piece of trivia for me on that one.
Well, do you want to get your mind off of it by giving your Knives out of Fives rating for Orphan?
I would give it 5 Knives. I really liked it. I had a blast. I thought that, was it perfect? No, I wanted something to happen to the, not that I wanted something to happen to the grandma, but it felt like kind of a dropped plot line.
Somebody
a little bit.
Somebody should have killed that
fucking
grandma.
Somebody should have killed that grandma. It felt like I was expecting there to be something with the grandma and there wasn't something with the grandma. So that felt a little missing to me.
I literally forgot the grandma existed.
Yeah, I mean, anyway. she might as well not, other than that one moment. But I thought that they set up so many things and then paid them off really well. I thought everyone gave a great performance. I thought that they, like, Max's deafness used in this role was, like, so well done and gorgeous and scary and atmospheric and really, like, added to the tension. I loved that they had a real actress playing her who has hearing impairments. I liked that the frozen pond paid off. I liked that the hidey hole paid off. I liked that they set up the flowers and the flowers pay off. Like, there's so many little things where I felt like they did a good job circling back to something from earlier in the film. I loved it. I thought it was great. Five times.
Sid, do you want to go next?
I'm going to give this a 3.5 out of 5. Sure. I think I just have too much adoptee trauma to fully enjoy this movie. It's too close to home for me.
Sure.
Which, very real. You know, is a weird thing to be able to say.
You wouldn't expect someone to really be able to relate to this movie, but, you know, there
if
are
anyone
real
could,
children
it would
out
be
there.
Sydney. Yeah. Well, ugh. I'm so sorry it brought up bad memories of your youth, Sid. Fuck. I love this movie. I loved it on the first watch. It blew my fucking mind. On the second watch, it was fun to know what was coming, except for the bone breaky part. That was bad to know it was coming. I was very upset. I think that this is like a 4.8 for me. I don't know. I love it. It didn't make me feel like high highs and low lows as much as I wanted
it
to.
Not the high highs and lows of American football or whatever, high school football.
Yeah. I didn't watch Friday Night Lights, so I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Oh, it was Riverdale.
Oh, shit. I was
so
sure
it was
Friday Night Lights.
In prison.
I have watched Riverdale, so that was done with me. And I would like to apologize. I would like to apologize on the record. but that said, I mean, I don't know. It's a really, really fun concept, and it's executed beautifully, really beautifully. There's not much I can say except for we have to do first kill.
I mean, Five Knives, I'm on board.
Yeah, I don't want to hype it up too much. It's not like it's amazing. It's what it is. It's a high camp beauty.
Well, if they're giving me more of the black light neon art, I'm all about it.
It's got Julia Stiles.
Oh, well, I'm in. Julia Stiles.
Yeah. So that's all I have to say. but that brings us to the end of Orphan. And what a wild ride. I hope you got those winter vibes we were talking about. And that it brings us into a new era of the pod where I would like to eat my words because I have said no to Chelsea so
many
times.
Shut me down many a time.
Shut her down over the last year and a half since we did our first themed month.
Only Monica's allowed to pitch themed months, I guess.
Right? Okay, It's not true. I'm sorry. We did a theme month before, and it was when the podcast was young, and so it didn't do amazing, but I think it's a sleeper hit. I'm going to go in right now. You saw the artwork last week when we did make two weeks ago, when we did Megan. We did doll month back in 2021 in the spring, and we did four doll movies in 1 month, and it was fucking insane. and you should go back and listen to every single one of the episodes. We did
especially
Animal
Magic,
Creation, Child's Play.
Yeah and Monica's
Play,
being so mean to
the
Magic,
boy,
so you guys
and Magic. I am not being mean to Magic. I just know
flop.
How I called it a stinker. It is just happens to be the episode that we have with the least amount of views. And so if you would like to listen to it, you should. It has nothing to do with anything. It's just, you know, people don't know about the sleeper hit from like 1978 Magic
with
starring Anthony Hopkins.
Young
about
Anthony Hopkins.
About a marionette.
And Margaret. She plays Cinderella in the 10th Kingdom. That's a celebrity to me.
Okay. I love that for you. I love you on that journey. but anyway, this idea was born out of a long, long longing for the first movie that is going to kick off this month. I've loved this movie since it first came out. And it gives me this specific feeling where I feel spooked, I feel in love, and I feel utter despair. And that has a and the movie plagued me for a long period of time on end. So that's what inspired us to do Romance Month for the month of February. And what a better time to do it than Love Month. But it's a horror podcast still. So we're doing those special, special romances that have something fucked up going on with them as well.
Love.
Spooky, spooky love. It could be like, you know, something as innocent as Twilight. It's not going to be Twilight. We already
did
that.
We did Twilight, yeah.
You fall in love with a vampire. Oh my god. I just was listening to the New Moon soundtrack like all day today. So like don't talk about it too much or you're gonna sway me to add it.
I'm still down.
We
for
have
it.
Too many other considerations already.
But I'm it doesn't give me that it. Same it's not the same that, type the sense of despair. The sense of despair comes from how this I feel like it's badly wrong that I love this love so much because they do bad things. You know what I mean? So the first movie for Romance Month is going to be Crimson Peak, a Guillermo del Toro movie that was not beloved by all, but that's because they didn't fucking get it. But I got it.
Oh, I love this movie.
I fell asleep in this movie, so I'm excited to pay attention all the way through for the first time.
It is a gothic romance, and it's got Tom Hiddleston in it, and that's pretty much all you need to tell me. But also Jessica Chastain is in it, and she's maybe one of the sexiest people alive. And Mia
Wasikowska.
I almost said Wea Farrow. Mia Farrow. I said Wea. I'm having a hard time. Just pretend. Anyway, we're doing a theme month. It's romance month and prepare to feel love, but also despair hand in hand.
Hand in unlovable hands.
Do you think that people are going to want to listen to that? I hope so.
I hope so. People love that Mountain Goat song.
Yeah.
You're coming down with me.
Perfect. It's beautiful. Anyway, why not start out the love for romance month early by writing us a 5-star review? We've been getting quite a few of them lately. Shout out to Struggle Scorpio for giving us maybe the best review we have ever received. It was hilarious and we loved it. And I almost cried because I thought it was so funny.
And for being a Scorpio, the best.
Like recognizes like.
Exactly.
Yeah, see that? If you write a review that's so spicy, you could get a shout out. Oh my God. if you make it this far into the episode. And then why not also follow us on social media? We are on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, and now YouTube at Spooky_Tuesday. And if you didn't get it in the last episode, we're uploading all of our episodes to YouTube now. So if for some reason that's changing your listening experience, well, there you go. You have it. And if you have friends who only use YouTube, tell them. And then we're also Spooky Tuesday Pod on Facebook and Tumblr and Spooky Tuesday on Letterboxd. Thanks for listening.
Bye, Spookies.
Don't let me die, Mommy.
I'm not your fucking mommy!
Spooky Tuesday was created by Monica Height, Sydney Thompson, and Chelsea Duff, and edited by Sydney Thompson. Our gorgeously spooky tunes are all thanks to Tamra Simons, who you can follow on Instagram at Captain Tamra. And our podcast art is by Mary Murphy, who you can find on Instagram at the_moon_OMG.